Madam Lieutenant Governor, Mr. Speaker, Madam Speaker, let me start over again here. Madam Lieutenant Governor, Mr. President, Madam Speaker, legislative leaders, legislators, justices and judges, elected officials, distinguished guests, family, friends, and fellow Iowans. I'm honored and humbled to once again address a joint session of the General Assembly, delivering the condition of the state for the final time as your governor. For 22 years, I have addressed this body as governor, and today I want to especially welcome the 22 new legislators who are with us from both sides of the aisle who were elected in November. Your constituents sent you to work hard, to work for them, and to help make Iowa a better place. I hope you're filled with the same sense of excitement and eagerness I had when I first served in the legislature in 1973. Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and I look forward to working with each of you and listening to your ideas on how to make our state an even better place for families to live, work, and grow. In that spirit, I am today extending an invitation to each legislator to meet with me personally during this legislative session. We also gather again with shared sadness, returning to do our work without our friend, Senator Joe Tseng from Davenport. Joe was a devout Catholic and a true statesman. We enjoyed his contagious and positive personality and working with him. As I look back at my years of public service, I'm thankful to those Iowans who stepped forward to serve their fellow citizens. In particular, please join me in applauding those Iowans who have helped make our state and nation safer by serving in the military, law enforcement, and first responders. Since taking office in 2011, we've made the necessary changes to strengthen our economy and improve the quality of life across our state. We've made tough decisions to give Iowans a smaller and smarter government. We've stayed the course with an unwavering commitment to create jobs, increase family incomes, reduce the size of government, and give Iowa students a globally competitive education. We provided significant tax relief for Iowans the past 5 years, especially for commercial property taxpayers. And last month, Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and leaders of the Economic Development Authority and the Department of Transportation unveiled Iowa's most comprehensive energy plan. The plan was developed with collaboration from the private sector, the public sector, educators, nonprofits, and utilities. Iowa is already a leader in low-cost and renewable energy. The comprehensive new energy plan will help build on our past energy successes and reaffirms our commitment to maintaining Iowa's energy leadership for the future. I'm proud we've made government smaller and smarter. Our unemployment in the state has dropped from 6.2% to 3.8%. The state has helped attract $13.5 billion in private sector capital investments, which have translated to great-paying jobs across Iowa. And more Iowans have been employed these past few years than any other period in our state's history. We've also made the tough decisions to ensure government lives within its means, like Iowa families must do. We've accomplished this with a relentless focus on fiscal discipline, demanding budget predictability, fully restoring our Iowa reserve accounts, and reducing the state's debt liability. Together, we've made progress towards our goal of restoring Iowa schools to best in the nation through a series of landmark reforms and innovative policies. To improve Iowa's education standing, we needed to make sure more is done to help our hardworking teachers make sure they have the tools necessary to succeed, given higher expectations for all students. So we created the new teacher leadership system that better utilizes the expertise of top teachers to improve education, instruction, and foster collaboration. I'm proud to say that every public school in Iowa today is participating in the teacher leadership system. To ensure that our children are prepared for the 21st century, we advanced a nationally recognized STEM initiative that gives students the confidence and skills for rewarding careers. The STEM initiative is led by Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds and Kemen Industries President and CEO, Dr. Chris Nelson, and has seen outstanding growth and success. Sustaining these measures over time is critical to get the right results for our students and our state. The ability of Iowans to overcome challenges bolsters my optimism about our state's future. When faced with challenges, Iowans consistently seek opportunities. Some of the challenges that we've overcome, like the farm crisis of the 1980s, tore at the very fabric of our communities. In 1980s, Bloomfield, Iowa, a community in Davis County in southeast Iowa, struggled like many other communities across the state. An uninsured bank in Bloomfield closed in 1983 and caused great loss for area families and businesses, and area farmers were straddled with debt and limited market opportunities for their crops. However, through a persistent focus on economic diversification and an entrepreneurial spirit to rebuild its community, Bloomfield now has new manufacturers that are growing alongside innovative startups. And to continue their effort to stay on the cutting edge, community leaders are instituting aggressive strategies to become Iowa's first energy-independent community by the year 2030. I visited Bloomfield last year and was impressed with their Main Street revitalization, a new hardware store, and M3 fabrication manufacturing plant. And Woodbine, Iowa, is another example of a community that took its future into its own hands. The community show how an integrated approach to community revitalization that focuses on historical preservation and community sustainability can redefine a struggling small rural community. Woodbine also had a bank close in the 1980s, but the community turned its challenge into future growth and diversification. Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and I visited Woodbine and were impressed with the success of their Main Street program. In Waterloo, Iowa, after experiencing economic challenges throughout the previous three decades, embraced the challenge of reshaping its industrial heritage to succeed in modern times. Cedar Valley Tech Works has made Waterloo a nationally recognized leader for manufacturing innovation. And John Deere continues to be a leading manufacturer and innovator in Waterloo. In the balcony today, our leaders from Bloomfield, Woodbine, and Waterloo, please join me in congratulating them on their accomplishments and supporting their future success. Where are they? Iowa's industries are increasingly high-tech, including advanced manufacturing. In total, Iowa has over 6,100 manufacturers that contribute over $31 billion to Iowa's economy and employ over 200,000 Iowans. Over the next year, the Iowa Economic Development Authority will work with Iowa manufacturers to advance a year of manufacturing to help grow this important part of Iowa's economy. We should also be proud that Iowa remains an agriculture powerhouse that feeds and fuels the world, thanks to the hard work and innovation of Iowa's farmers and agriculture producers. We just set an all-time record for ethanol production. We set a new record for biodiesel production by adding an additional 55 million gallons, and we lead the nation in the percentage of electricity generated by wind. We now generate over 35% of our electricity from wind. We expect that number to exceed 40% by the year 2020. We love wind. Over the last 30 years, we've significantly added to our agriculture commodities. We've diversified the Iowa economy by expanding exports and supporting growth in biofuels, wind energy, data centers, fertilizer plants, biorenewable chemicals, advanced manufacturing, insurance, and financial services. These newer industries employ hundreds of thousands of Iowans in rewarding careers. And while I'm pleased with this progress and optimistic about our future, I believe there's more work to be done. We must seize the opportunity that is before us. This new General Assembly brings new dynamics, new expectations, and new opportunities to deliver positive results for Iowans. Our state is in an admirable position. Many states are strapped with crushing debt, poor credit ratings, and a bleak economic outlook. But Iowa is a shining example of what hard work and smart, tough choices can do for growing business and nurturing families. While the December revenue estimate is lower than previous projections, the estimate still shows a modest increase in state revenues. Although we faced a headwind out of Washington, D.C., that is stifling our agricultural economy, we still have positive revenue growth. But we must proceed with caution and not repeat the mistakes of the past. With that prudence in mind, I present my proposed adjustments to the current fiscal year budget to you today. These adjustments are required by law. My proposal does not include across-the-board cuts, does not reduce funding for K through 12 education, does not reduce property tax credits, and does not include furloughs of state employees. The budget reductions I'm recommending for this fiscal year are difficult, but they maintain our funding mutual priorities. I'm committed to working with legislative leaders and with all of you to implement these adjustments. For the coming biennium, I am presenting a complete two-year budget that is balanced each year and meets our five-year projections for a sustainable future. This budget is based on the principles laid out by the Iowa Taxpayers Association. It prioritizes education, health care, economic development, and public safety, and it redirects family planning money to organizations that focus on providing health care for women and eliminates taxpayer funding for organizations that perform abortions. On my first trip to China in 1984, I learned that the Chinese word for danger and opportunity is one and the same. Today, America and Iowa exist in a challenging world. We must seize the opportunity to make it a better place. In 2010, Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and I promised to reduce the size and scope of government. I'm proud to report that we do have a smaller, smarter government. With a steady focus on improving services for our citizens in a more timely and efficient manner. Yet while the size of government is smaller, the benefits for public employees at the state and local level have increased. Unfortunately, the cost of these benefits have grown dramatically because of our antiquated collective bargaining system that has led to over 500 health care plans, many of which are inefficient and way too costly for public employees and Iowa taxpayers. Under our present system, just a few adverse health outcomes can destroy the budget of a city, county, or school district. By replacing this system with one comprehensive statewide contract, we can spread the risk and dramatically reduce the costs. Using a uniform health care benefit system similar to the IPRS program for retirement, we can provide quality health care at a significantly lower cost and give local governments more flexibility to provide better wages and meet other needs. The statewide health care contract also needs to reward employees who take ownership of their own health by conducting health risk assessments and taking actions to improve their own health. We have made a commitment to examine each and every dollar of revenue and expenditure in order to maximize efficiency and respect our hardworking taxpayers. We are committed to a smaller and smarter government that seeks innovative ways to provide services rather than blind adherence to the way things have always been done. I'm asking this General Assembly to take a comprehensive review of all of Iowa's state boards and commissions to address unnecessary barriers that prevent competition and raise costs. I encourage you to ask the tough questions that challenge the status quo. In Iowa, 90% of our general fund budget is spent on three items: K through 12 education, Medicaid, and employee wages and benefits. The state has significantly increased funding for education since 2011, amounting to over $654 million additional dollars. Education and job training are the foundation for our future economic growth. Growing our state's talent pipeline needs to be a top priority. Even with modest revenue growth, my recommendations include an increase of $78.8 million for K-12 education for fiscal year 2018 and an additional $63.5 million for fiscal year 2019, which equates to roughly 2% growth each year. So this year, let's show Iowans we can make these decisions early and meet the legal requirements of setting supplemental state aid for fiscal years 2018 and 19 in the first 30 days. The second big driver in the state's budget is health and human services spending. Together, we've transformed our mental health system to a community-based model. We've obtained a federal waiver for our Iowa Health and Wellness Plan, which has reduced charity care for Iowa hospitals. And like 39 other states, we've modernized our Medicaid program. As a result, we've created a new system where more Iowans have access to mental health services closer to home than ever before. More Iowans have health insurance than ever before, and more than 80 new value-added services are now being offered under our modernized Medicaid program. We've also replaced the old Medicaid system with a coordinated team of healthcare professionals to ensure that patients see the right provider at the right time. As a result of these reforms and innovation, we have improved the focus on health outcomes and saved taxpayers $110 million. Our increase in education funding last year was made possible because of our modernized Medicaid efforts. Without these vital reforms, the budget choices before us today would be twice as hard. In order to grow Iowa, we must also look at policies and reforms that will continue growing family incomes. One way to do that is to close the skills gap, which in many ways is the biggest challenge facing us in the next decade. That's why Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and I set the Future Ready Iowa goal that 70% of Iowa's workforce should have education and training beyond high school by the year 2025. Today, less than half the workforce has that. Accomplishing this ambitious goal will create unprecedented opportunities for Iowans and better position our state to compete in the increasingly knowledge-based digital economy. That's why we established the Future Ready Iowa Alliance, which is co-chaired by Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and Dan Houston from Principal, and they will be making recommendations by October 31, 2017, to assure that more Iowans have the careers they deserve and employers can hire the skilled workers they need to grow and innovate. Even with a tight budget, we should continue to prioritize initiatives that will grow Iowa's talent pipeline, like the STEM initiative, registered apprenticeships, and work-based learning for Iowa students. Please help me recognize students who are here today from Jackson Elementary School in Des Moines, Bondurant Farrar Middle School, and Waukee High School, which has one of the premier work-based learning programs in the state. Students, thank you. The students in the gallery represent children from across Iowa who are counting on all of us to modernize the schools for the 21st century. That's why Lieutenant Governor Reynolds and I launched the Comprehensive Computer Science Initiative. We're encouraging every high school to offer at least one high-quality computer science course, every middle school to provide exploratory computer science, and every elementary school to provide an introduction to computer science. All students need to learn how computers operate because it's fundamental to their life and work. Computer science will provide students a chance to join one of the fastest growing and best paying fields. No student should miss out on this opportunity because of where they live. This is another step to better align education and training with essential workforce needs. We all care deeply about the safety of our families, our friends, and our neighbors. However, a troubling trend has begun to emerge that threatens Iowa's safety on our roads. Traffic deaths were 315 in 2015, but jumped to 402 in 2016. That is unacceptable. Earlier this year, I called on the Department of Public Safety and the Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau to lead a working group to study this disturbing trend. The group, with the support of key stakeholders, including law enforcement, made recommendations that are worth your consideration. I'm asking you to take a hard look at these recommendations and evaluate which can be put into law to make our roads safer. Unfortunately, too many innocent bicyclists, motorcyclists, pedestrians, and passengers have lost their lives on our roads. Last year, I received a handwritten note from Christine and Daryl Harkin, parents of Grace Harkin, who live near Riceville. They wrote, "Our daughter Gracie's life was so sadly ended on July 29, 2015, by someone who was driving and texting. Grace was biking safely and lawfully during a morning bike ride when a driver who was texting struck and killed her." They went on to write, "Grace would have forgiven the driver and moved forward. That's what we've chosen to do, but we miss her so. Grace Harkin's life was tragically ended way too early. Modern technology should come with new responsibilities. I ask all Iowans to join the Iowa law enforcement community, first responders, the League of Cities, all of our major cell phone carriers, the insurance industry, and the medical community in demanding real change in the laws for distracted and impaired drivers." Last year, I called on the legislature to send me a water quality improvement bill. I was pleased with the bipartisan progress made on this front here in the House of Representatives with the passage of House File 2541 last session. This bill was approved by the Agriculture, Ways and Means, and Appropriations Committees and passed with 65 votes. This bill provided long-term, dedicated growing source of revenue to help implement projects to improve habitat and water quality directed by the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy. The bill provided funding for community conservation practices and improvements for wastewater and drinking water facilities. By leading on this issue together, we have the opportunity to modernize Iowa's agricultural infrastructure, create jobs in rural Iowa, and promote collaboration between urban and rural communities. I believe our discussion should begin with the House passed bill from last session. I hope we can work together to perfect and improve the legislation that will provide a long-term, dedicated, growing source of revenue for water quality improvements. I have been so blessed to serve as your governor, serving the state I love for 22 years. I'm confident Iowa will continue to move forward because Iowans care deeply about their neighbors, their communities, and creating an even better future. I'm extremely thankful for perhaps the most patient person in the state, my wife, Chris. As she has served as First Lady with grace, she's welcomed Iowans and visitors from around the world to Terrace Hill, and she's volunteered to help in many ways, including reading to students from Jackson Elementary School. She, Chris, and my entire family, thank you for your sacrifice during my time of service, public service. Thank you very much. Chris told me she felt bad about missing out on reading to with first graders from Jackson Elementary this morning, but honey, I appreciate you being here. I'm also thankful for the friendships that we've made in all 99 counties, friendships that we will always cherish. And I'm grateful for the prayers from Iowans that have encouraged me along the way. There's no better job in the world than being governor of the state that you love. But sometimes we're called to serve in ways that we never imagined. As I approach the U.S. Senate confirmation process, my priority continues to be serving the people of Iowa with the same energy and passion that I brought to this office each and every day. Thank you. God bless you and all the people of Iowa.
We've been listening to Governor Terry Branstad deliver his 22nd condition of the state address, likely his final condition of the state address in Iowa. This broadcast was made possible with assistance from Iowa Public Television. I'm Charity Nebbe. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio. And now we're going to talk about what we heard during the governor's speech. And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Joining me right now is Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, of course. Thanks for having me.
And of course, in the very beginning of the speech today, Governor Branstad said, "This is my final condition of the state address." Did this feel like a farewell address to you?
Well, initially it did. You know, going into the speech, I think there were three things that I was wondering how Governor Branstad would balance in terms one, the first one being, you know, simply his legacy, as you mentioned, as the longest serving governor in the history of the United States. Then talking also about second thing with unified control, unified Republican control for the first time in 20 years. And then the third element was, you know, how would he set the table for his successor, Lieutenant Governor Reynolds? So I think, you know, you saw elements of all three throughout the speech.
And not much talk of China, although it did pop up a couple of times during the speech.
No, you're right. And that came up right at the end, which is sort of what you'd expect as part of that farewell emphasis of the address. But, you know, I think what was fascinating to me when you look at the speech overall is initially it started off like his, you know, last few condition of the state addresses in 2014, 2015, 2016 in terms of credit taking, which is what all governors do with these types of speeches. But in the past, you know, Governor Branstad has been somewhat reluctant or hesitant to talk about some of these hot button issues. And that was not the case today. I mean, he directly mentioned, you know, eliminating funding for organizations that perform abortions. He directly mentioned collective bargaining and rolling back some of and restructuring of collective bargaining rights. Those were two issues going into the speech that I was a little bit unsure as to whether he would mention, because in the past he's sort of avoided those issues. He's used this address to highlight what the state is doing well, some past accomplishments, and then really put forward a set of sort of what you'd expect to be bipartisan proposals.
So why do you think the change this year? Is it because of the Republican control of the House and the Senate?
I think it is. I think you have to look at it that, you know, this was a case where he was perhaps more focused than I expected on setting the table for a very conservative agenda. And this was his final address, and he sees this perhaps as part of his legacy.
He did bring up Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds a number of times during the address. How do you feel he laid the table for her going forward if he does get confirmed as the ambassador to China?
Well, I think he did it in two ways. One, he talked about the past accomplishments of the administration in terms of the economic factors that are improving in the state. But then he also mentioned, as you said, some of the initiatives that she's taken on individually in terms of the STEM initiatives, in terms of the energy plan, some of the initiatives with skills training. So I think he's, you know, setting the table for her in terms of talking about the things she's already doing and that we expect to see going forward.
I want to bring Iowa Public Radio State House reporter Joyce Russell into the conversation now. Hello, Joyce.
Hi, Charity.
And we've been talking about how in some ways this sounded like a farewell address. The tone was a little bit different this year, possibly because of Republican control of both the House and the Senate. Was there a different energy in the room today from your perspective, Joyce?
Well, I think there were fewer instances of partisan applause. I think that the, you know, I think you were just talking about the abortion issue and diverting funding away from Planned Parenthood. And that applause was completely, I shouldn't say completely partisan because I can't see everybody.
But it was long and loud, right.
It was long and loud and it was partisan. And actually, it just about everything else was very, very bipartisan applause and standing ovations.
I have to note that the tone of the speech today was extremely positive, looking back on things that have been accomplished, painting a really rosy economic picture of the state of Iowa. And Chris, of course, we all know that Governor Terry Branstad was a big supporter of our now president-elect Donald Trump. And during that whole campaign, a rosy economic picture was not painted for the people of Iowa or people of anywhere in the United States. Do you think that this represents a sort of shift from that tone, Chris?
Well, it's a shift in the tone, but it's not unexpected. As I said, governors typically use these speeches to engage in credit-taking, and he used this speech, as most governors do, to talk about past accomplishments of the administration, things that are going well in the state, things that have worked well in the state. And this is a pattern for Governor Branstad as well, in terms of starting off the speech talking about economic indicators that are improving across the state in terms of, you know, business investments, unemployment rate, and other factors. So that's not expected, that he talked about Iowa being in an admirable position. And by all accounts, Iowa is. If you look at Iowa, the fiscal condition in Iowa compared to states in the Midwest, states throughout the country, Iowa is doing quite well.
Now, of course,
I think there was a sense in which he was looking back more than I think he has in past speeches. He talked at some length about the farm crisis of the 80s. Well, that's been a while. And he frequently refers to that because he was governor at that time. But to emphasize that in his condition of the state speech, I thought was a little unusual. But he used that as an example of communities struggling and now coming back big and vital and strong.
So in addition to focusing on a positive change that has taken place in Iowa, of course, we are facing a major budget deficit, and Governor Branstad was setting forth his ideas for how to balance the budget this year. He made some proclamations that school funding will not be cut. He also said that property taxes will not increase, no state furloughs. What do you think we can take away from what he was saying about his priorities as far as looking at the budget? Chris? Or Joyce? Joyce.
I think I would disagree with you calling that a major budget deficit. It's $100 million from this year's budget. And in the grand scheme of things, I think that they view it, and I think they correctly view it, as kind of a temporary blip. And cutting $100 million, while it will be a stress on some agencies, and I should mention here in particular, $25 million is going to be cut from the Regents' budgets for this fiscal year. And that's quite a big hit. But I don't think, I wouldn't call it a major budget deficit. And I think for the most part, these agencies are going to be able to absorb these cuts between now and the end of the fiscal year.
Chris, you want to add something to that?
Well, yeah, I would say, and he also added the other element was there would be no across-the-board cuts. And I agree with Joyce. You know, you're talking about a $7.4 billion budget approximately. And yes, there's the $100 million shortfall, but that's a shortfall from the December estimate. And revenue growth across the state over the year has been growing. And so, I think with the way that's going to be addressed, I heard two things that were kind of interesting. One was that he proposed a complete two-year budget. You know, as we've talked after previous addresses, states are generally moving away from biennial budgeting. In this case now, he's talking about a complete two-year budget. I believe in the past, he's done 1 year and, 85-86% of the next year's budget. So that was interesting. And then the other part of it was, just budgeting for that K-12. He mentioned that he wants the legislature to do both years within the first 30 days. And that's a bit of a break with Republican leadership, at least some of the statements we've heard from the Republican leadership in the last couple of days.
It is, and I noticed, I thought there's a little bit of schizophrenia going on here, I think, because he got big bipartisan applause when he said that, when he said, the law requires, let's follow the law and set school funding, not just for the next year, but the year after that, set that within the first 30 days of the session. And just yesterday, Republicans in the House were saying they want to change the law. Mm-hmm. You know, the flip side of that, the reason for that law is so that schools can plan and so that school funding doesn't get mixed up with other competitive things in the budget. But the other side of that that Republicans argue is you don't know what the resources are going to be that far out. And they just yesterday said they want to change the law. They don't really intend to do that. They intend to set the school funding for next year, but not for the year after that. So there's some kind of disconnect going on there.
Well, and of course, just to refresh everyone's memory, this has been a major bone of contention in recent years. It's been the last thing decided in the legislative session in recent years.
That's right.
Let's go to the phones. Tim is on the line in Mason City with a question about school funding. Hi, Tim.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just have a general question for Ms. Russell, and I'm sorry I didn't get Chris's last name, and it has to do with the use of statistics. Sometimes the governor uses raw numbers, like in the number of Iowans working. Sometimes uses percentage for growth or reduction, and sometimes just adjectives, like growing, timely, or significant. On energy, he used raw numbers having to do with ethanol and then a percentage increase in the amount of wind. And when he was talking about K-12 funding, he used all three different ones. So I'm not critical of him for that, but can your experts help me digest how to absorb all this when it changes so much?
All right, Tim, thanks a lot for your call. Of course, that's something we hear in a lot of different ways from a lot of politicians. But what did the governor say about school funding? He said he's not going to cut it. And let's lay out the other things he said.
Well, he said that he wouldn't be cutting school funding as part of this $100 million cut in this year's budget. Schools and a number of other areas were exempt, and then the rest of state government absorbed those cuts. For next year and the year after, he's proposing a 2% increase in basic state aid to schools. This is roughly what he's been recommending in recent years. It falls far short of what Democrats have tried to get approved in recent years, but were unsuccessful. So 2%, I'm sure schools would not be happy to view it this way, but 2% has sort of become the new normal, at least in recent years.
Well, and he did make a statement about making progress, making Iowa schools the best in the nation. Again, there are a number of different rankings on education in different ways, and Iowa is far from the top. U.S. News and World Report ranked Iowa high schools 45th in the nation. Iowa received a grade of C- from Education Week's Quality Counts 2016 report. So although it's hard to really know where we stand, best in the nation is not where we are right now, probably.
Yeah, maybe hard to say. And to follow up with Tim's point about the use of statistics, I think it's actually a really good question. You know, when you get into all of this, as one of you mentioned, you know, politicians are going to use, or elected officials are going to use percentages differently. And so you always have to be careful about how you interpret them. And the best advice you can give is kind of just to always try to figure out the base number. What is the base number from which they're trying to figure out a percent or a percentage point increase? Because those are two very different things.
Now, as we started talking, Chris, you mentioned that the governor brought up his ideas about collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that he didn't actually specifically say collective bargaining, but he did say that he wants to create a health benefit program that will cover all state workers. So it will be uniform across the state. This is a proposal that is going to be highly controversial, right?
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, and it was a surprise to me that it was actually included in the address. You know, because this is, as I said, he tends to shy away from these more hot button issues. But this is one that is obviously going to get a lot of attention. It's going to get a lot of attention immediately within the legislature. As you mentioned, he didn't say collective bargaining explicitly, but did talk about replacing with a one contract state employees with a single contract for healthcare, and in making those adjustments in that particular area. But yeah, this is absolutely a hot button issue, because as soon as you start talking about this, you know, people immediately think of Wisconsin and what happened in Wisconsin, and the enormous protests and the disagreements that happened in Wisconsin, the reforms that happened there. So you're absolutely right. This is going to be something that's going to be talked about throughout the session, and is going to be very contentious.
Well, and he also Joyce.
I was just going to add, in the budget briefing that we had earlier this morning, his aides, the governor's aides, said that he would not be offering a collective bargaining bill, but that he does stand in support of changes in collective bargaining. He says the law is outdated, it's too expensive. The health thing is his main deal, but he makes other sweeping statements about Iowa's collective bargaining law, and you can be sure that Republicans in the legislature are going to be putting some things forward on collective bargaining. And the other thing that his aides said that he fully supports but would not be offering a bill on is school choice. Republicans are almost certainly going to offer, in the past they've actually passed voucher bills to allow just the direct diversion of state funds to private schools. And I don't know if the governor would go that far, but I do know that he supports what the advocates call school choice.
We are nearly out of time, and I do want to touch on the fact that he did spend quite a bit of time talking about manufacturing successes in Iowa and making Iowa more attractive to manufacturing in the future. Of course, that's something that we're also hearing from the president-elect as well. How significant do you see that in Iowa's economy right now, Chris?
Well, it has been significant. It's continuing to be significant. I mean, we've seen Governor Branstad, the initiatives that he's pushed over since coming back into office in 2011. A big part of that has been trying to attract businesses to come to the state. He mentioned some of the data centers in the condition of the state address, but talking about, you know, providing tax incentives, providing some sort of economic incentives for these businesses to come to the state. And that's been a big emphasis of his administration since 2011. I think he was just, you know, re-emphasizing what's been accomplished and then talking about the need for that to continue going forward. And if you think about Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, you know, I would expect that to continue to be a point of emphasis.
And he also brought up water quality, which of course has been a very big issue in Iowa in recent years. He seemed to feel that progress was made during the last legislative session. He wants to pick up where that House bill that did get passed, although did not make it through the Senate, where that bill left off. Joyce, what are lawmakers saying about water quality right now?
Well, I think that bill that passed the House is almost, some version of that is almost certainly going to be approved this year. And in a nutshell, what the reason the Democrats in the Senate didn't take it up is because it doesn't raise any new revenues for this very expensive problem, which is water quality. And instead, it diverts other state funds, appropriates general fund money without, and which is going to be in direct competition with education and other priorities. So that's why it's been controversial. But I think that the wheels are pretty well greased on that. I think we're going to see something similar to what passed the House last year.
The governor, toward the end of the speech, brought up all of the fatalities that have been happening on Iowa's roadways and is encouraging stronger change, or real change, he says, for laws for distracted and impaired drivers. What do you think we'll see as far as proposals for, quote, real change in those laws, Joyce?
Well, the two things that his staff briefed us on this morning was, you know, you heard him talk about the young woman who was either a bicyclist or a pedestrian, I can't remember, who was killed by a driver who was texting. And so he's going to propose tougher penalties for in cases where a texting driver strikes a motorist or a bicyclist. And then a second thing he's proposing having to do with drunk driving. It's a 24/7 monitoring thing. So somebody who's had multiple convictions for drunk driving would have to repeatedly, like more than one time a day, check in somewhere and have a breathalyzer test. This is something that's growing in popularity in other states. So those are the two things that he's recommending. I know that some people in the legislature are saying that texting thing doesn't go nearly far enough. Some people want to just ban texting while driving.
Well, Joyce Russell, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Iowa Public Radio's Statehouse reporter Joyce Russell. Chris Larimer, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Of course, we began the hour by listening to Governor Terry Branstad's 22nd and possibly final condition of the state address. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.